The Lord be with you. A reading from the Holy Gospel according to Matthew. At that time, Jesus exclaimed, "I give praise to you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, for although you have hidden these things from the wise and the learned, you have revealed them to little ones. Yes, Father, such has been your gracious will. All things have been handed over to me by my Father. No one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son wishes to reveal him. Come to me, all you who labor and are burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am meek and humble of heart, and you will find rest for yourselves. For my yoke is easy and my burden light." The Gospel of the Lord. By way of this homily, I would like to Sorry about that. I don't think the evil one wants me to give this homily, I suppose. So by way of this homily, I would like to exercise my option as the preacher to give a homily not based on the readings of the day, but on the civic holiday we celebrated yesterday, Independence Day, and its relevance to us as Catholics in these extraordinary times. At this time every year, I like to spend a few hours on the 4th of July thinking about the relationship between the church and the state, between freedom and tyranny, between democracy and religion. And having studied political science in college and now theology at the doctoral level, I can't help but be concerned about what is going on around us in the culture. And I'm sure I'm not alone. Recently, I was reading up on the history of the Pledge of Allegiance. Crafted in 1892, it went through some alterations till its present form in 1954. And we all know how the Pledge of Allegiance ends. We all say, "One nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all." But we must ask in these days, are we one nation? Nominally. Are we under God? Well, if you mean, do we live under God's moral law? Definitely not. Are we indivisible? Hardly. Is there justice and liberty for all? Definitely not. But here, even as a racial minority, I don't want to focus on race today, which seems to be very fashionable in these crazy times, but on something that transcends all races: religious faith and its place in our American experiment. Now, I use the word experiment deliberately because our republic was never granted divine assurance, like the church was by Jesus, that it would survive the gates of hell. And that should cause us to take pause and consider exactly how fragile our democracy is today, for it has direct implications on our lives as believing Catholics. At the time of the Revolutionary War, the richest man in the 13 colonies was Charles Carroll. Carroll happened to be the only Catholic signer of the Declaration of Independence. And like his fellow signers, Carroll was risking his entire fortune and his very life by signing a treasonous document. And to drive home the strength of his conviction that secession from the crown was necessary, he signed his name on the declaration, Charles Carroll of Carrollton in Maryland, as if to tell the British, if you have been mistaken for some other Charles Carroll, I just want you to know which one signed this document, because I'll be waiting for you when you come to pick me up at my house. Carroll had a cousin, John Carroll, who was a Jesuit. He was the first Archbishop of Baltimore, which was the diocese that covered the entire 13 colonies at the time of the founding of the country. Archbishop Carroll also founded what became Georgetown University, as well as the first seminary in this country, St. Mary's in Baltimore, where I taught as a member of that faculty some years ago. Carol had invited the Sulpicians from Paris, who themselves were escaping the French Revolution of 1789. Many don't know this, but one of Archbishop Carroll's closest friends was a Quaker from Pennsylvania. You might have heard of his name, Benjamin Franklin. Franklin and Archbishop Carroll were sent by the Founding Fathers to Canada to try to enlist the support of the Canadian colonists in our struggle for independence. Unfortunately, that attempt failed. Nevertheless, Carroll wrote the Pope at the time that he thought that the idea of America was the best thing that could have ever happened to Catholics in the 13 colonies. And why? Well, in addition to their commitment to natural law and natural rights of prescind from it, that were both inalienable and inviolable, the founders were first fiercely committed to religious freedom and the concept that no one could be discriminated against on the basis of their creed, the religious faith. For Carroll, this was a major breakthrough for Catholics, who were often discriminated against in the colonies where Anglicans and other Protestants mostly dominated. Even in Catholic Maryland, Catholics were not always spared of discrimination. But what would the founders think today of the state of religious liberty? We have on our hands an outright, blatant attack on Christians in general and Catholics in particular. And no longer is the prejudice veiled. It's quite overt. Just recently, some have called for the removal of all stained glass windows depicting Jesus and Mary as white, because this is apparently intrinsically racist. Similarly, St. Michael slaying a blackened figure, Satan, is also racist. Never mind that angels don't have bodies, and therefore don't have racial identity, and that never mind that since ancient times, light has always been depicted in contrast to darkness as an analogy for good versus evil, even our sacred images must come down. And we've seen in recent weeks even statues of St. Junipero Serra, the great missionary to California, a Franciscan priest, came crashing down. As of yesterday, the Navy has threatened court-martials for any midshipman who attends an indoor religious service off base, just like this one. If you're a Navy midshipman and you're on base and you go back to the base, you are threatened with a court-martial. However, it's okay if you protest. It's okay if you go and run errands off base. And it's okay if you go to indoor parties. But you may not attend church. Who could forget 3 years ago, the confirmation hearings for Judge Amy Coney Barrett? Judge Barrett is a devout Catholic, mother of seven, including two adopted children from Haiti, and a special needs child. And oh yeah, guess what she does for a living, as if that weren't enough. She's a professor of law at Notre Dame. Disgusted with Judge Barrett's pro-life views, Senator Dianne Feinstein of California pointedly told the then nominee, quote, "The dogma lives loudly within you." And that's a concern, end of quote. The dogma was a reference to Barrett's Catholic faith and Feinstein's suggestion that Judge Barrett, as an observant Catholic, could not be an impartial judge. And while this is certainly the most notorious instance of a nominee being grilled about his or her Christian faith, it is far from the only one. It is, I would suggest, a contemporary formulation of signs that used to hang in parts of our largest cities, "Irish need not apply." Its modern version, "Catholics need not apply." So we might ask, why were the founders so committed to religious freedom? We're all familiar with the phrase in the Declaration, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. One of the reasons why Catholics are so unapologetically pro-life is because life is the foundational right without which liberty and the pursuit of happiness cannot be experienced. If you can't be guaranteed your right to life, what difference do the other two classes of rights really matter anyway? Catholics who see the world this day are often accused of being single-issue voters. We are not. We are primary-issue voters. I've always said, if I can't trust a politician to get some simple things right in this life, like we shouldn't kill babies, how could I possibly trust them to get much more complex and nuanced and negotiable issues such as taxes and education and welfare and the defense of the country correctly? The founders also associated the pursuit of happiness, listed in the Declaration, with the pursuit of virtue. Let me say that again. When you read the pursuit of happiness, the founders understood that to mean the pursuit of virtue. Virtue, not licentiousness. George Washington, in his first inaugural address, spoke of, quote, the indissoluble union between virtue and happiness. Again, when the founders speak of the pursuit of happiness, they're not talking about the pursuit of libertine behavior that places no control on the libido. For the founders, the pursuit of happiness meant the pursuit of virtue. And why was virtue so crucial in the founders' mind? Because the founders knew that a democratic republic could not survive, let alone flourish, without a virtuous populace. And if you feel like the wheels are coming off in our country, it has everything to do with the fact that we are no longer a nation under God. We have abandoned God and have abandoned virtue. It's a simple fact. Similarly, liberty, freedom, is the moral condition for pursuing a virtuous life. It's the freedom to do what I ought, which we know from the moral law, not simply whatever I want, which is licentiousness and actually enslaves us to vice. Therefore, our freedom can never be separated from the truth about nature and God and the virtuous life He calls us to. But how far have we strayed? How we have abused our freedom to pursue every conceivable perversion known to man. Do you think that these false ideas of liberty have actually infected the highest realms of our leadership? Yes, they have. Let me read you a quote. This one author wrote, quote, implicit in the Constitution's structure and the very idea of ordered liberty was a rejection of absolute truth. You know who wrote that? Barack Obama in The Audacity of Hope. No one could be more distant from the founders' vision that the republic was founded on certain unchanging, immutable truths. And if those truths about the human person and our inalienable and inviolable rights that all persons are created equal go out the window, so does the republic. Were the founders flawed men? Yes, they were. Do some of them have pasts that are regrettable? Absolutely. Who can deny it? But did they have these basic concepts right? Undeniably so. And yet we have decided to abandon them. So we might ask as a final question today, simply this: why are we so hated? Why are we so hated? In a word, secularists believe in the perfection of man, in this life can only be achieved through the intervention of the state. The state. Catholics and Christians think otherwise. For us, we can only be perfected in this life, and even then we recognize those limits, through the saving power of Jesus Christ and the grace that He provides us to bring us to our true end, our ultimate good, which is heaven, eternal life. The founders knew that the state was not the agent of salvation. Therefore, they favored limited government and maximum freedom to allow us to be free to pursue a virtuous life which was learned through religious practice. This was in the best interests of the nation. The secularists, meanwhile, cannot handle our belief that there is more to life than what we experience here on earth, and that the state is not the salvation solution. The state cannot save us. I've been at the deathbed, bedside of people dying on their deathbed many times. I have never heard a single person cry out to the state to save them. So, if the state is our salvation and Christ is not, every Catholic and Christian remnant of civilization, every sign and symbol and institution must come crashing down. That's the real reason why our persecutors want our statues and our religious symbols taken away. That's the difference between the American Revolution and the French Revolution. The French Revolution, 13 years after the American Revolution, sought to destroy the church. The American Revolution intended to protect the church from the state. You see, the European mind sees faith as opposed to reason. The American mind has historically seen faith and reason wedded together. But the secularists cannot accept that. It is a violation of their dogma. So it seems like we may be on the precipice of a French Revolution in this country. And I'm afraid to tell you, brothers and sisters, we would be dead center in its crosshairs. But not all hope is lost. There is, after all, the Lord, who promised to remain with us until the end of the age. So we must ask, as we conclude, what is the best thing we can do for our beleaguered nation? I say, be an exceptional Catholic. Be an exceptional Catholic. It's patriotic. When we act virtuously, we act in the best interest of our souls and our bodies, our families, our communities, and our country. Political activism, while necessary, isn't enough. Each of us individually has to rededicate ourselves to living virtuously, even if that costs us dearly. In the end, nothing else will matter. Or we can sell out on our faith, as many Catholics have done. But would it be worth the price paid in the end? You see, as Catholics, we actually believe in judgment. We believe in the reward of the saints and the condemnation of the damned. And while our cities burn, our statues topple, and the American experiment seems to come crashing down all around us, we have no other recourse but to turn to Him who transcends all time and history. Brothers and sisters, pray fervently for our beleaguered nation and place your trust in Him who is the Lord and King of all history. May God bless each of you, and may God bless the United States of America.